The podcast you're about to hear was recorded at the Football Writers Festival in Sydney in July 2023, a celebration of football, writing and ideas. It is brought to you by Fair Play Publishing and Streamgate.
Welcome to this session. I'm a bit surprised. I thought that our timekeeper was going to do the introduction, but I'll do the introduction. To this session, which is, even though I know I've been spending a bit of time talking about bookmakers, and not in the nicest possible way, this is still called World Cup Tips. Though I expect you will just enjoy the information rather than take it as information to be used for putting bets on what is going to happen in a couple of days' time. So, World Cup Tips, the expert's view. So now we're going to concentrate on the actual writer side, mostly of football and the competition which is starting. Which day are we? Sorry, I'm a bit jet-lagged. In 3 days' time now, 20th July, absolutely. And for this panel, we've gathered quite a few experts, obviously, which I'm going to call to the stage if they're here, I believe so. In no particular order, apart from the fact that it's the way that their names are put in my little sheet of paper here. Thomas Hitzelsberger, are you here, Thomas? Could you make your way to the stage, please? I think I wouldn't say we know all about Thomas now after these 3 days, but we've enjoyed the contributions very, very much indeed. And you might get a couple of questions about Germany in this. Alicia Carnavas, whom we heard in the debate a little bit earlier. Alicia, could you come to the stage now? Aha. Well, Alicia will be here with us in a minute, I'm sure. Francis, would you please make your way to the stage? Former Socceroo, associated with Melbourne Knights, South Melbourne, Marconi Stallions, and now a vice president of FIFPro, Francis Auritefe. The much-traveled coach, or to give him his proper title, the itinerant coach, which is the name of his book. So Steve Darby, could you please join us? An Irish international who was born in Canada. We heard her yesterday in, I thought, was one of the standout sessions of this festival. I think that we were all quite stunned and shocked by what we heard, and also struck by the courage of Kira McCormack. And so, Kira, if you could make your way to the stage, please. And Kira was joined by another Republic of Ireland International, and who was also on that memorable session, Claire Shine, the author also of Scoring Goals in the Dark. And to complement this this panel of footballers, ex-footballers and managers, we've got also two specialists who are going to help us for two teams specifically, if they don't mind. And they are Olga Bagatini of Brazil. Please. And Jean Williams, who might have a word or two to say about the Lionesses. I hope you had the chance to see Jean's amazing coats. So Jean, please make your way. And I think we've got a full... I hope there is room enough for you. Okay, we might have to share a few the microphones on a few occasions. Are you all right? Okay, so... with no further ado, because I think there should be quite a lot of time left for Q&A, and also because I'm always a bit wary of these tips things, and I can give you an example of why I am a bit worried about that. We did Guardian Football Weekly tips about before the Qatar World Cup, and I had to do the group in which Saudi Arabia was drawn, and I did a bit of research, or so I thought, and I said, there's no chance they will actually score a goal or win a point. And of course, first game, what happened? They won 2-1 against the future world champions, Argentina. So there you go. The first thing I would like to ask to absolutely everybody, and feel free, by the way, all of you to intervene, is that it's the first World Cup with 32 teams, right? We had 16 teams in Germany in 2011. We went to 24 teams for Canada and France in 2014 and 2019. And now we've gone to 32 teams. And hello, Alicia. My first question to you would be, is it too many Is it too many teams? Who would like to take this on? Anybody feels inspired? Or is it just right for the stage of development that women's football is in the world at the moment? I don't know. Kira?
I think it's, I don't actually think it's too many in the sense that I think the impact of making a World Cup for countries really explodes sort of the attention. And I think there's a lot of, yeah, there's a lot of new countries, just even as a fan, that I'm looking forward to watching. So I, again, in terms of researching all the teams is maybe a little more overwhelming than it would have been in the past. But in terms of the, you know, and even again, when you look at the $30,000 that every player in the event's getting, like that's life-changing money probably for players from places like Haiti or, you know, Philippines or, you know, so I think from that perspective as well, I think that's a huge positive.
Great. Well, we've got a little teaser before we start talking for Ernest. And Dennis, I think you're queued up. I think quite a few of you have now seen this. It has gone absolutely viral on social networks since it was posted by a British journalist, actually, even though it's not a British clip. And if you haven't seen it, well, have a look at this and please keep your eyes peeled until the very end of the clip. Dennis?
Oui, bien sûr que c'est passé. Maintenant faut que ça aille au bout.
Allez.
Ouais, c'est bien joué. Il y a plus qu'à la pousser.
Allez,
il y a plus qu'à la pousser.
C'est pénalty,
oh,
ça.
C'est voilà. Fait. Les bleus qui reviennent dans le match.
Et allez, encore le droit de rêver.
Avec le pied droit. Quel toucher de balle extraordinaire. Là, il y a un bon ballon de foot à jouer.
Bien fait le.
Merci.
Oui, bravo. Il est direct, le centre entré, oh, le chéri de l'intérieur,
à la tête piquée,
ok,
super,
ah, elle est belle cette équipe,
ouais, c'est ça, le football qu'on aime, c'est ça, les bleus qu'on aime.
To say that's quite something, isn't it? I think they've already secured all the awards for the best advertising campaign, so maybe that in 2019 there was not as much enthusiasm, certainly not in Paris. In Lyon there was, about the Women's World Cup in France, there should have been, but they've made up a little bit with this, and here we go. All right. World Cup tips, I suppose, the first, I mean, is the teams we think can go far in the competition, and also the teams which can surprise us, the players we think are going to confirm their status within the women's game, but also the players what we feel and hope will actually be revelations at this tournament. So if I start by the most basic questions, if you have a World Cup tip, of course, is that which team do you actually fancy to go the whole way in this competition? And Alicia, you're looking at me, so you're getting the question first, but everybody please, so Alicia.
Sold my soul then, just looking at you, Philippe. Look, I have said on air about a month ago, Germany, to take home the silverware, this World Cup. And I know a few people are talking Germany. Thomas, you'll be very happy with me.
Okay.
But look, I just feel like they're a runner-up of last year's Euros. Am I correct? Yes, last year's Euros, yes. But just formidable, formidable opponents all the time, the Germans. They always produce a clinical, disciplined team. And flying under the radar, Thomas, I'm watching that team.
What do you think, Thomas?
I hope you're right, but I have to confess I was interviewed about a week ago. Mm-hmm. I've been asked the same question. I said America is going to win it. So I can't really change my mind now. Bonita, she said the same to me. She believes that Germany is going to be very strong, correct? You did. But of course, I hope you're right, but I just believe the Americans do it again, make the treble, win it for three times. Maybe it's just like a gut feeling, as I said, Megan Rapinoe, the fact that she knows that she's going to retire. I just believe in those cheesy stories that she's going to do it again.
Are there any others among you who actually fancy the Germans or the Americans? What about you? For example, Claire?
I actually fancy Australia.
Really?
Yeah, I haven't seen and played against them in 2021, and the team that they are now and how far they've come throughout their build-up, the players that they've developed, you know, I think they're going to surprise a lot of people. And I have said that since the beginning of the year, since, you know, Ireland actually qualified for the World Cup, and then getting into the same group, I was like, oh no, but I'm strongly backing Australia on this one.
Australia, I mean, and I see Jean, you're nodding. You also fancy them?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's been a long time in the building. I thought the friendly against England was a mistake by England. I thought Australia learned more about us than we learned about them, and also the result. So I think the power of a World Cup on home soil, as we know, has historically been super important if they can handle the pressure.
Mm-hmm. And well, if we talk about Australia, I mean, we've got, I'm looking at a Socceroo right here. What are your feelings, actually, Francis, about that?
Yeah, I think Australia's build-up has been very, very good. I think when you look at where they were 4 years ago, and they were in a bit of a hole, really. I mean, new coach had to come in and develop a new style of play, a different way of playing. Then we've had COVID and all that. And I think a lot of players, we were a bit worried, actually, about the depth, I have to say, about the depth of our national team, because a number of players retired or just stopped playing, and we were a bit worried about whether we're going to have the depth. But now I think over the last year, the build-up, we've got stronger and stronger with the games that we've played. So I think we're ready to do something extraordinary.
Do you think so, Alicia? Possible? Just?
Sorry?
No, Alicia. Feels so just?
Everything's possible. It's a World Cup.
Right. Including Saudi Arabia beating Argentina, as I remember. Yes, absolutely. But is there anything that what can hold them back? I mean, can the home advantage be actually something that is double-edged in a tournament, especially of that length?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we speak about the pressure. I speak about it often. Jean, you've just touched on it as well. Sam Kerr converts that, and she says, pressure is a privilege. And I think it's a real positive in the attitude shift, mm-hmm, of absorbing these occasions. We haven't seen a World Cup on home soil, men's or women's, but 80,000 people on Thursday night out at Homebush. It's definitely about how that pressure is absorbed and converted into performance. So if anyone is excellent at doing that, it's Sam Kerr.
Could there be a home advantage as well for New Zealand? I'm looking at Steve. Do you think that home advantage can play a role for them? Because they're not really fancied by many people.
I think basically New Zealand are like Saudi Arabia for you. No chance. Mm. I think there's about six teams that can win it. It all depends on, I'm convinced, injury. Because if some of the key players in these teams are so far ahead of possibly the others, the injuries could come into it. And with, sadly, the amount of ACLs happening now in the female game.
Yep.
And, of course, logically, this is going to be the highest level most of the girls will have played at. So the game will be faster, more intense. And, again, logic, that's when the ACLs may well prevail. And I'd love Australia to win it. I don't think they would. If I was coaching against Australia, I'd be getting my centre-half to smash Sam Kerr and basically see if she either gets sent off or injured. Because, you know, we're being brutal. It's a World Cup because who's going to score the goals? Maybe Mary Fowler, but realistically, if you can get Kerr out of the equation, that does greatly reduce the Aussies' chances.
Mm. Claire, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, the Republic had a rather good result against Australia not that long ago. So what do you make actually of the Republic's chance? I mean, do they have... What about qualification first and then the ambition beyond that?
I think when we played them in 2021, we beat them 3-2, as far as I can remember. And that was a massive shock. You know, you could see it on the Aussies' faces that they weren't impressed. I don't think they were expecting Ireland to go out and play the way that they did. I think they'll be more prepared now than what they were when we played against them back then. But Ireland are going to be ready. They're going to have a game plan and they're going to do everything that they can to execute. Mm. You know, I think like every team, they have weaknesses, and it's whether or not they can exploit those weaknesses. It all comes down to it. I think, you know, there's also 4,000 fans flying over from Ireland today. And I know there's another couple of thousand living here. So, on that front as well, I think, you know, they're going to have a massive backing, and they know that. It's whether or not they can execute it on the day, but, you know, anything can happen in international football. Like we saw in one of the build-up games to the World Cup, Zambia beating Germany. That wasn't expected, so we need to expect the unexpected sometimes as well. And, I think Ireland can definitely get a result.
And Kira, you're nodding, you think so too.
No, I think that's the beauty of where the women's game is at right now. Like to see Zambia beating Germany, you know, and obviously it's a build-up game. So are they putting out their best lineup and all? You can debate all that stuff, but like for Zambia to be in the conversation with Germany, let alone beating them, I think it sets a great stage for the kind of possibilities that are ahead at this World Cup that maybe in the past weren't there. So I agree with what Claire's saying for sure.
There's one name we haven't, well, several names we haven't mentioned yet. One of them is France, obviously. We know what happened in Melbourne. We might not necessarily have a lot to read in that. I don't know. The fact is that, you know, losing Amandine Henry is a huge, huge blow. But it leads me to another question, which is going to hover around this whole World Cup. I cannot remember a global tournament of that magnitude, be it men's or women, by the way, in which so many teams have had so many problems before the tournament. I was trying to make a list, and in fact, it would have been a shorter list if I decided to go for the teams which haven't got problems of one kind or the other, be it injuries, but not just injuries. And we have to talk about the case of Canada, obviously. I mean, how is the situation that you talked about yesterday, how is it going to affect actually the team's performance and what we can expect from them?
I think, again, outside of the abuse, there's a huge financial situation, and our general secretary was quoted a month ago saying that Canada Soccer might be going bankrupt. Like, that's how sort of arduous the financial situation is. I think, you know, again, obviously from an abuse perspective, like, that's run rampant through lots of different teams. And you know, I think even again in the case of Spain, you're actually, you know, missing some of the top players in the world because they're sitting out because they don't, you know, agree with the coaching staff or they find them abusive or whatever. So, but I think that being said, like a huge thing with, you know, these high level events is that nothing's ever going to be perfect. And I think a piece of it is sort of the resiliency factor of who can sort of put these events behind them. For sure, Canada. I mean, the players wanted to go on strike in March before the She Believes Cup, and only because of a technicality with Canadian labor law, they sort of were forced to play, and they didn't perform very well. So I think from a Canadian perspective, I think the sad thing is there's been so much turmoil for so many months now that I don't think it's sort of the acute thing that it was back in March. I think it's just sort of like a white noise going on behind the scenes that unfortunately they've just had to cope with, and I don't necessarily... Yeah, I mean, I think, again, resiliency is going to be a key piece of who's successful, and I just think it's just another, you know, thing that if Canada does well, they have to overcome.
Francis, I'm turning to you because of your position at FIFPro. I mean, Isn't that actually a major concern of you? I mean, if you see, when you see the problems of so many of those teams, I mean, I'm thinking, well, Spain we've talked about, there have been, I mean, France has had its own problems. We remember what happened when basically the French players went more or less on strike and decided not to play with the national team anymore because it was of huge problems with the former coach, Corinne Diacre, Hervé Renard, with the best laundered white shirt in world football is at the helm. And we know that he can achieve miracles, as he had done when we were Zambia, and he's done with the Ivory Coast, as he's done with Saudi Arabia, so we shall see about that. But there are, I mean, so many other teams which have got prime Nigeria, we mentioned. France has got Zambia as well, has got problems. I mean, can you remember a tournament in which there has been so many problems around so many teams?
Before I answer that question, I'm no longer on the FIFA board. I haven't been on a FIFA board for about a year and a half, but I was vice president of FIFA board until about, I think, at the end of 2021. So I just thought I'd let you all guys know that. But, and Kate Gill, who's this co-CEO of the PFA, she actually replaced me. So to answer your question, that's all right. That's okay. That's what let people know that. As far as the labour issues are concerned, yes, this is one of the biggest problems that we've got in global football at the moment. And we've seen this issue around, we've seen the Matildas putting out a video today around labour rights. There's a massive imbalance in global football around player representation and the ability to actually collectively bargain their work conditions. In that, Australia is very fortunate. We've had a very strong union for quite a while, and obviously for the men and women. And so we have collective bargaining agreements with our national association, as do some of the other national associations, like I think Denmark, Sweden, and one or two others. But the ones who don't, I mean, England's having issues with the Football Association around bonuses. And that's the biggest issue you have in global football, because of this massive, massive power imbalance where the players in these countries can't even collectively bargain their positions. The national association is just unilaterally imposing conditions on the players. And also, when you look at issues such as Spain as well, for example, the union which governs a men's football in Spain doesn't represent women. So AFE doesn't actually represent women. So because of all those issues around the representation of women by unions, and then you've got the issues of abuse. We've had France with the issues with the French national team, with players pulling out. And I know that in France, some of those players have now come back. In Spain, a whole load of players pulled out. A few of them gone back, but there are still a number who've decided not to go back. Yeah, that issue of abuse and the work conditions of the players, their human rights, the right to collectively bargain your position and to be protected legally by the law and these sorts of things, there's massive, massive gaps in global football. And this is creating conditions which is leading to the abuse of women players in particular, not just in terms of sexual abuse and physical abuse, but mental abuse as well that we've seen. And I think we heard quite strongly from yesterday from Chiara and Claire. These are the things. So there's massive, massive industrial conflagrations. When you put all that together, Nigeria, I mean, before every World Cup, again, Nigeria is another country where there is no union for the national, and even Nigeria is not even a member of FIFPro. So not only that, and Canada has only had its union for about 2 or 3 years, I believe. So again, and because of that lack of protection, sometimes FIFPro has been able to help, especially with countries that are members of FIFPro. But generally, with the countries that are not members of FIFPro, it's not really much FIFPro can do.
Yeah, well, sorry for throwing a little bit of a dampener, but I think that will be something, a question that will go throughout the whole tournament. I mean, if you go back to the actual teams in the tournament and the ones we should expect normally to do well, I'm looking at Jean and I'm looking at Olga here. Let's start with England and the Lionesses, because I think back home, because that's my home, the support is just extraordinary after what happened to them in the Euros, obviously. But is the team we're going to see in Australia and New Zealand at the same level today that it was during that tournament, that triumph?
Well, it's a very different feat, isn't it? So I think people forget how recently Serena Weidman was brought into the England setup before the Euro success. It was only literally a year before. And obviously she was appointed as a previous Euros winner, also on home soil. So she's kind of replicated that particular feat at the highest level. This is a very different tournament. And I know that England have worked really hard on sort of the same sort of narratives of family. They've been based out on the Gold Coast since the 5th of July. And they very much see that as being the same kind of base that they had in London during the Women's Euros. And actually, in some ways, Serena Weidman's preparation for that, she flew the whole team out, they played a friendly, and then they flew in to the Women's Euros. So that's like, this is when the tournament starts. I know the level of preparation is such that they have been working with the likes of Qantas, on things like jet lag, so each player's been given a blue light to help them sleep and an orange light to help them wake up. So the level of preparation and meticulousness and the kind of psychological preparation is phenomenal, but we are missing key players. I mean, you know, we're missing a Leah Williamson as captain, who was just honestly superb. She was immense through the Women's Euros. Obviously Beth Mead, because we had Hemp and Mead, so you've got those you know, attackers down the wing, and we're not seeing the same kind of formation, but there is strength in depth. So I thought that Kira Walsh was a hugely underrated player during the Women's Euros, and she's been pivotal. The promotion of Millie Bright to captain is an interesting choice for me, as she's matured from the World Cup in France, where I thought her temperament was a little bit suspect, especially against the US. They definitely went after her. and she responded. As captain, she can't afford to do that. So, and then there's the kind of trickery of Lauren James. So we've got huge potential, and there's real strength in depth in that squad. And I think they've been very clever the way that they've taken Jill Scott out there doing these kind of programs, because you've got that old head in the camp keeping things quite steady in that kind of winning mentality. So I think England will be there or thereabouts, but even the most ardent England fan would have to say in Wembley, just before the kickoff of the Women's Euros, when we heard that Alexandra Pott was injured, we were like, yes. if we don't win it now, we're never going to win it.
What about Brazil, Olga? Have they prepared in as scientific a way as the Lionesses have, with blue lights and yellow lights? Is that what you said, Jean? Yeah, I should remember that tip as well for the trip back. What state are they in at the moment?
I'll just give some context here from what Brazil looks like now and where we were at the last World Cup. After Pia Sandhagen came to coach Brazil, everything started to change inside of the Brazilian football. Because before her, the game was ruined by male white men who were interested in the development of the game. So we had the coach in the 2019 World Cup. He went to the World Cup without winning for 9 games, and then he went to the World Cup, and I think that would never happen in the Brazilian men's football. So we had Brazil not a good stage group in 2019, and that great match against France, and I think we can put that great match on the talent of the players and they are willing to win because they weren't get good preparation. So then after the World Cup, all the world was looking to women's football. Pia Sandhagen was hired, and now I think we're like, we had the best preparation ever. So,
okay.
And we also have Marta's last dance in the World Cup. Of course, it's hard to compare a 4-year work with the work the other countries has been doing for so long. So I think we're not like super hopeful because we know other great teams are there. But I think we're going to be seeing the best Brazil in years, best Brazil in history, actually, because I think the respect for the game is finally changing inside the federation.
Wow. So, okay, so you see them go quite deep in the tournament, actually.
Yeah, I also, when I left, it's fun because When I left Brazil, I was trying to be super skeptical and realistic. And now I think being here in Australia with the spirit of the World Cup, I mean, like, of course we're going to the final, Marta and everything, it happens. But I think also Pia, she has a strong squad. We are not depending on Marta anymore. We have great young players. Aline Gomes, she's not in the 23 list, she's not in the 26 list. She just turned 18 here in Australia. I'm not sure if she's playing, but she's definitely a name to keep a look on, because she's going to be a superstar soon. But we have Dabinha, and we have other great young players playing around Europe and in the US that are going to be in the Brazilian squad. Okay. And it's funny because Brazil is at the Gold Coast for the preparation, and they just had like this friendly match, what they're calling like the kids team, that is the youngest players, and the older veteran team. And the kids team won, and they posted this video of the kids like, kids team, the youngest players. So I think we can bet on this balance between the experience of the players and the speed of the young ones, and I think we're going to be seeing Brazil do a great job in this World Cup.
It's lovely. Sorry, I was going to say, yes, Francis, of course, but I was saying it's lovely to hear something positive. It's actually, you really believe, don't you? You really believe. Yes, sorry, Francis.
No, I was really interesting in what you're saying about Brazil, because, yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of commentary from their women about lack of respect from the Federation for many years. And I think we've seen that in South America in general as well, with Argentina and Colombia and places like that. And just to connect that, that connects to what I was about to say, that there's a real gendered inequality around global football, around the way women's football is treated compared to men, especially around World Cups, when you look at issues such as prize money and the massive disparity. I mean, we're looking at the moment, the World Cup prize money went up, I think in the last World Cup was 30 million and now it's 110. But in the Qatar World Cup, the prize money for the men was 440 million. And these are figures that weren't even collectively bargained. And so when you think about it, so women are playing for a quarter of what men are playing for. So if you're going to give a lot of these issues around these industrial issues we've seen, whether it's England, whether it's in places like England and Nigeria and all these other countries, Canada, the economics is different around women's football and the way it's men, because women really do rely on the money that they get from playing in World Cups. And so this is why the fight for prize money is really, really important, because it's going to make such a huge difference to the economic circumstances of women, the fact that they can concentrate on a game and be treated as professionals. And I think that because of those gendered inequalities, FIFPro has a massive role to play in actually being able to be the organisation that can actually collectively bargain global pay and conditions for nationalities, because that way you'll be able to hold the national associations are not going to be in control of doling out the money to the players, and that's a lot of the problems, because even with some of these countries, the money goes to national associations and it disappears into the pockets of administrators. So that's why FIFPro has a huge, huge role in being the organisation now that should collectively bargain the conditions for women globally for World Cups.
One team we haven't mentioned, even though they've been world champions in the past, is Japan, with their such individual style of play, I mean, which I find absolutely riveting, I must say. I'm turning to you, Alicia. Yes? Japan. If I just say, the question is Japan. It's not a question, of course, but the question is Japan.
The buzzword, Japan. Look, similar to Germany, very disciplined team always, and a very athletic team as well. Actually, one of my first under-19 internationals was against Japan, and one thing I'll never forget is the discipline in which those girls play. It's incredible level of discipline. We went off for a little 30-minute drink break in the heat of Canadian summer in 2002, and not one Japanese player had a drink break. They followed us. They'd been told to mark their player, and so they. So I was literally like, would you like a sip? It's 30 degrees, like we're out here together. That is the immense discipline of the Japanese teams in world football. Thomas, I'm sure you've had your time against Japanese men's teams as well, but they come here and I think they carry the weight of Asia in many, many ways as well, the Japanese. And I think they're a bit of a beacon for Asian football as well when it comes to World Cup. So I love their jerseys, particularly the away jersey. I'm going to go and get that at Ultra Football during the week because it's a nice, nice kit. But I think what they represent is huge, and I think they'll go quite far as well.
And since you're talking about Asian football, there's one, I suppose, Asian team that you're going to follow particularly closely, which is the Philippines, because they have a goal called Alan Stajic, whom you know quite well, I believe.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of believers in this room of the Philippines and their journey, and just the excitement as well. I mean, we've got three Australian coaches with that team, which is fantastic for our coaching repertoire in world football. Stajic's no... it's a household name, really, for Australian football, but what he's managed to do with that team as well in such a short amount of time and actually take them to their maiden World Cup is fantastic. So I think all eyes will be watching the Philippines as well, particularly Sydney siders, to see how far they go.
Another team which is making its debut is one that you know, Steve, which is Vietnam. Which I have to say, I know absolutely nothing about. Can you enlighten us about Vietnam and their hopes? Their first participation as well, by the way.
They're called Bong Da Nu, which means football girls, and the boys are called Bong Da Nam. So you'll hear that word, Bong Da Nu, stated around. The difference in their preparation is between, say, USA, Australia, the European teams. It's like riding a bike to driving a Ferrari. One of my ex-players is the manager of the team, not the coach, the manager. And she tells me their preparation, and they are totally in awe of what the other nations are doing. But two things that are really, really important about this team is, one, that 30,000 you spoke about. That is a lot of money, believe me. When I was playing, coaching them, I once said to a player, hey, you know, you don't perform better, I'll send you back to the rice fields. Joking. That was a mistake, because it wasn't a joke. They do go, some of them would go back to the rice fields to work if they weren't professional footballers. And they are professional, just as a very lowly paid profession. And have you ever been in a rice field, by the way? Don't go. It's back-breaking. So they took me there to show me what it was like. But the other thing that is they're really looking forward to is playing USA, for obvious reasons. You know, there's a few memories, not for these girls because they're too young, but their family will be certainly putting memories into their heads because of that. And they're not going to beat the Yanks. Of course they're not. But the aim will be, if they can just keep a respectable score against the Netherlands, against the USA, and maybe to get something against Portugal. Because Thailand got battered by the Yanks in the last World Cup, and that didn't do the game any good inside Thailand. Their girls got laughed at, which is what we don't need. That, to me, is the one drawback of having 32 nations, particularly if you're going to get USA against Vietnam. You know, it could well be double figures, realistically, especially in the last 30 minutes of the game when the better athletes will take over. But certainly, I tell you what, if you get a chance to look at them when they're singing the national anthem, they mean it. They absolutely mean it. They love their country. They're playing for their country. They're not playing for themselves. The money's fantastic, but they are playing for Vietnam, believe me.
Right, well, we'll follow them, Claire, absolutely. Go on, Vietnam. Or what do you call them, the football girls?
Bong Da Nu.
Bong Da Nu. Okay. How much time have we got, Mr. Timekeeper? Because I haven't heard the fateful music. Thank goodness for that. Are we doing okay? Okay.
It's all questions,
Yeah, absolutely. But still, can we go, I know, quick fire session. I know we all hate that because suddenly you're thrown a curveball and you think, I can't even speak anymore. But if you were, let's talk about players. If there was one player that you think we should follow, that player who can come out of this World Cup as maybe not a superstar, but a player, a real revelation. I'll start with you, Thomas. Is there one player, for example, in the German team that we should be looking at in particular?
I looked at a website, ABC. They did a report today, a few days ago, you know, mentioned these players, and I thought, who am I going to mention? But of course, I'm going to stick with the German team, and Lena Oberdorf. She's back on the pitch. I saw some footage this morning, which is quite good. She's still very young. She's, you know, I think in that number six role, she's going to do a really, really good job. And thankfully, Alexandra Popp, she's going to be fit, and hopefully she's going to play against England and score plenty of goals. But I know it's not a quick answer, sorry. I was just going to say...
No, that's fine.
You know, the same struggles with Caroline Simon. She picked up an ACL injury against Zambia. So that's the same issue. But fortunately, you hear so many problems with so many teams. The German team, the only problem was the ACL injury. They talked about equal pay in the past, but it's just, you know, it's still an issue, of course. But overall, they seem to be in good spirit. Things are going well. And my tip is Lena Oberdorf. Watch her.
Okay. What about you, Claire?
I'm going to stick to an Irish. I'm going to say Denise O'Sullivan. You know, she's been MVP for North Carolina for 3 years running. And this is the first opportunity to get to play at a world stage. Unfortunately, she picked up an injury against Colombia the other day. But, you know, knowing Denise as well as I do, she'd probably play with two broken legs. So she's the backbone of the Irish team. She's come through the wars to get to where she is today, and you know, it's her time to shine, and I think she's going to be incredible for the Ireland team this.
Kira, what about you?
I think going with Canadian performances in the past, the goalkeepers seem to play a huge role for Canada doing well, and Kaylin Sheridan, I think she was the NWSL Goalkeeper of the Year last year, and she doesn't get spoken about very much, so I think if Canada is going to do well, I think she's going to have a big breakout performance.
Steve.
Well, I think the Vietnamese goalkeeper is going to be busy and the Philippine keeper. But player I think I really like is a young player coming through is Smith of the USA, the striker. She can play. She really can. And one player who I think could be absolutely outstanding but could also be invisible is James of England. I want to say that as I actually don't think she knows what she's doing. In a sense that you can't predict that. She goes past people in the wrong places, but she dribbles in the wrong places, but do not do it well sometimes. So she could be scary for England, and I hope she is.
Which passes the baton up to you, Jean?
Romantically, I'd like it to be Mary Fowler's moment because I think that could be, you know, Kathy Freeman at the 2000 Olympic Games, you know, that kind of moment of national unity on home soil could really happen for Australia. But the player that I'm most delighted for is Jordan Nobbs for England, who I've followed her career right through her under 17s, 20s, and so on, and she always gets injured just before a major tournament. So I would like Jordan Nobbs to smash in a hat trick.
What about you, Alicia?
Jean, you took my player, Mary Fowler. But for me, Hilda Magaya, South Africa, Banyana Banyana. She is one of the few players from South Africa playing abroad in South Korea. So, and her performance in the African Cup of Nations was sensational. They're now African champs, of course. So that's a team probably flying under the radar, equal issues with pay. There was a big debacle a couple of weeks ago before they flew out with their farewell match. But I think if anything similar to Vietnam, like you spoke on, Steve, once that jersey's on and that pride in the nation, and Hilda's a fantastic player, one to watch.
Olga, you mentioned a couple of names already. Is there one under the radar, even for you? Well, not even for you, but one that we should be particularly aware of?
I think we need to look at the young ones, Ali Borges, Caroline, and Aline, if she plays. But for me, the name of Brazil, and might be the name of the World Cup this year, is Debinha. She's a striker, and she plays in the US for a few years now, and she is in a great shape, in a great moment. She was, I think, number 6 in FIFA's The Best last season. And she is now the key piece in the coach's system, so I think we need to pay attention to her. I hope she can score many beautiful goals.
So this leaves us with you, Frances.
I think a couple of players, they stole my player. I think Mary Fowler for me, it's just been incredible watching her development as a footballer, but not just as a footballer, but as a person as well. And I think she's just growing at the right time into the football tournament for this World Cup. And she's just got so much potential. I mean, it's scary. I think that if she keeps going the way she is, not only will she go on to be a great player for Australia by the time she finishes, I can see her also captaining the national team as well. I mean, she's outstanding off the field. The way she carries herself, her poise, her intelligence. She's just really impressive.
Right. I mean, we can't cover all 32 teams, obviously, in such little time. So there is a little bit of time left. So please, if you have questions, raise your hand. There's a roving mic. Let's not talk about that. Okay. No, James, I'm afraid.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes.
A question for Steve, really. On the Thailand game against the USA in the last World Cup, he mentioned that. I just wondered what he thought about the way that the American players celebrated goal after goal after goal, whether that was in the best spirits of the World Cup. And maybe if you want to open up to the players on the panel, ask how they would have celebrated around like that.
Well, I don't blame the Americans because, let's face it, they're Americans, aren't they? Yeah, that's what they're going to do. You expect that with them. But it felt, I was watching that in Southeast Asia at the time, and it was awful to watch because I knew the humiliation, to use the Thai word, the loss of face those girls received. The manager you saw on the side called Madam Pang, she's pumped millions into that team. She pulled out after that because she lost face. So the whole structure of the game was caused a downfall by that result. Again, I don't blame the players. If you're playing in the World Cup and you score a goal, you're going to be happy. And plus, it's culturally, that's what the Yanks do, isn't it? But it wasn't good for the Thais. That's certainly true.
What do you think then? Kira, yes.
I got into like not Twitter wars, but I like tweeted. I was, as a player, disgusted, to be honest. Like,
really?
Again, because I think it's a World Cup. I get that side of things, but I think like as players, like we have to recognize that there's massive discrepancies between teams, and to almost like it just felt gross to watch. And obviously, like Steve said, obviously ramifications for Thailand in a negative way, but I just felt as a player, like, you know, being from a country of privilege, like I just think that there's like a certain, it's not even about class, but it's about respect for like the fact that there's such disparity in the world and in the game. And that was such a moment where it was highlighted, and it felt wrong watching.
I see a lot of nodding heads. Yes, that's what you feel as
well. Yeah, I agree. I think when you're playing against really opponents that are significantly weaker, I mean, I'm playing those matches myself, I can only speak from personal experience, but it's not like people just have to, you just don't celebrate like you've won the World Cup. You know, you score your goal, you walk back to the halfway line, you kick off, and you just go until the game's over. And it just seemed like they were rubbing their faces in it, you know, the way they were celebrating each of the goals. And it didn't seem as if they were respecting their opponents, and I think for something like the World Cup, it's important that you respect your opponent, because as Kiara's saying, you know, especially at the stage that women's football is at the moment, there's still a massive disparity really between the stronger countries and the not so strong countries, unlike the Men's World Cup where there's not as much of a gap. So yeah, I think I didn't like it either.
Thomas, yes.
I didn't intend to talk about the men's game up here today for this hour, but what came to mind immediately was Germany playing Brazil, the men's in the semi-final when they beat them 7-1. And I think they did a great job, A, because they played the way they played, but every player realised at some point, we're going to win this game. And I think you can still professionally play, do your best and score goals, but act professionally. And like I said, you have a sense of humiliation and you don't want that. And it doesn't matter whether you're in a men's game, women's game. And I think they missed that in that game. So I do blame the American players the way they behaved. And that's why I think they shouldn't have done it. I mean, slightly different because they knew right at the start they were much better, unlike Germany, Brazil. But I think they all should have sensed like, okay, we're going to win this game, still give our best, but the way we celebrate should have been definitely different. Be different.
I think we could.
One thing to add to that:
yes?
The Aussies, Socceroos used to beat. I don't know if France has played in some of these games. They would beat the Cook Islands and these sides by massive scores. Did the Socceroos celebrate? No.
It wasn't like that.
Yeah.
Right. Time for a couple more questions, I hope. Yes? We have a mic. A gentleman here.
Three letters. Now, it's not Baba. Three letters have cast a pale hue across a number of the team's preparations. ACL. It's certainly hurt England. It's hurt the Netherlands. Australia has flirted with the pain as well. Why so many ACL injuries in women's football?
Right, I think we've only got like 5 minutes left. Let's give it a try.
Well, as most people will be aware, it's a complex issue. And the problem with it is that those kinds of studies, complex studies, have not been done. So as part of the first MARC medical panel that FIFA convened in 1999 to look at these particular issues, and it was mainly male researchers who were used to working with male players who produced the statistics and their findings, and the findings were so inaccurate that women are more likely to get ACL injuries, and it's anywhere between 4 and 8 times more likely than men, which is like hitting a barn door with a banjo in statistical terms, is that the holistic research has never been done. So if you look at evidence like the player autobiographies, Megan Rapinoe, after the 2015 World Cup had been held on hard surfaces in Canada for the first time, the FIFA report says that there were not particular injuries during that World Cup, but the number of players who had ACL injuries after that World Cup, including Rapinoe for the second time, was phenomenal. So we have to look at player physiognomy. We have to look at the playing conditions under which they're playing. And again, talking to the likes of Emma Hayes at Chelsea, she's very critical of their one club policy and says, you know, the women can't use the swimming baths until the men have finished. Sometimes they're having to return a couple of hours later to use ice baths, which makes it a total waste of time. So it really goes back to the industrial situation that these players are playing under, and to look at what they're being provided with in terms of rest and recuperation and all the rest of it. And that holistic study is yet to be done, although I am having conversations with the FA, the English FA, because obviously a lot of these injuries are taking place in England, and they know that they need to do something about it and look at the whole player.
Is it something that an impression you shared, Claire?
Yeah, I just want to add, I think overloading the players is a massive thing. I think the way the women's game has gone over such a short period of time, they have their games that have been scheduled have pretty much doubled. They have now got the same structure in the Champions League as the men's, so it's like a group stage that you get in, so it's added game time. You see in the documentary for the Matildas, Sam Kerr, she said she hadn't had longer than a week off in nearly 2.5 years. You know, and that's what the players are up against. They obviously don't want to say no. They want to participate in everything and every game and every competition as possible. But in England, specifically Arsenal, they have seen a significant amount of ACL injuries. It's going from, you know, international duty straight into Champions League, straight into league games, straight into cup games, and then all of a sudden then they come down with ACL injuries. I just think, you know, overloading women players on such a short space of time may have had a massive impact on it as well.
We've got time for one more question. Yes, gentleman in the blue shirt here.
Hi, Mary Fowler, Channel 7 Plus did a 4-10-minute episode documentary on it. If anybody's interested, it's excellent. My question is on the Matildas selection. I guess looking at that time available. It seemed to me to be selected in the 23 a lot of injured players undergone not much time producing. I just thought, when I compare that to other selection squads and whatever, it stood out to me that there'd be a lot of players in there that under other circumstances may not have even made that squad. Just interested in everybody's comment about selecting players who have potential to recover and or past efforts being rewarded, it seems, or needed.
Alicia, perhaps?
I felt those eyes on me, Philippe, there for a minute. Yeah. No, in Tony we trust. Right? That's very much the message out of camp and out of the selection process, and he's quite robust in his conversation over his plan for the last 2 years as well. So I completely understand where you're coming from. I've spoken on it as well quite a fair bit. It's that risk that we're taking, particularly in defence with injured parties or players that just simply haven't had minutes for a long time, a really, really long time. Kaya Simon, I believe they're giving until 5 p.m. Wednesday to prove fitness, but it was always her selection was for the month of August, not for the month of July. And if we think about the caliber of Kaya as a player and what she does in big matches, the plan is for what everyone's predicting, a semi and a final. But Tony's given her that grace, I guess, of saying, well, you've got until Wednesday the 19th for us to make a decision, which is 48 hours away, right? But it is a very delicate situation for the Matildas. It does put pressure on that squad selection. We've seen wonderful players from other teams left at home because of injuries and lack of match time. I think the tournament will play out and we'll see whether that was a good choice or maybe not so good.
It's a bit like the selecting Rooney or Beckham or Zidane. My goodness, yes, it doesn't all go necessarily very well, dare I say. It's risky anyway.
Yes.
Very risky.
Yes.
And any other questions? Yes, please, at the back of the room here. Do we have a roving mic? Can we... on the other side.
Am I audible?
Yes.
Just going back to the question, you know, which was asked a few minutes ago, the 13-0 scoreline, given it was also one of the introductory topics in FIFA's recent documentary series, All Roads Lead Down Under. And also because we have 8 teams about to make their debut at this edition, as people who influence I will not call you influencers because I hate the term myself, but as those who help shape public discourse, and many of you are broadcasters, journalists, what would your message to football fans, fellow broadcasters and journalists be, if not to the players, because we cannot perhaps influence them, as far as such score lines arising at the 2023 edition? Because as I mentioned earlier, 8 teams, the likes of Haiti, the Philippines, about to make their debut, and there is a degree of inevitability around a 13-0 score line, or much worse than that, emerging at AUNC 2023.
Who would like to take this on? Claire, you would be working for RTE. Would you be working on some of those games? And are you prepared yourself for this type of situation?
I haven't actually thought about it, to be honest. I just got told in our break that I was covering the England-Haiti game on RTE, so I will be going home to do my homework on them. And I'll have to probably think about it thoroughly before the game does arise, because it's something that I think does need to be shone a light on.
Jean?
Yeah, I think it's really important. I wrote about this when there was the England-Cameroon game, which many of you will remember from 2019, which saw absolute scenes from the Cameroon players. And I think the thing that I would caution is compassion for Cameroon, to understand not only how you could see in coaching terms that they were overstimulated. You know, they were so proud to represent their nation, but just didn't have the background, the training, the preparation, the mental preparation to be able to compose themselves sufficiently to give their best football. And I think what I would caution is compassion for these teams, and understand the journey that they've been on. Their victory is being at the World Cup. We wouldn't be talking about women's football in Haiti if they hadn't have qualified for the World Cup. So it's a huge opportunity, I think, for broadcasters and writers to shine a light on the conditions of the women in these countries, and to say, look at what they've achieved, given the very scarce resource that they have.
I just want to add to this. I basically want to say the same, but I think as a broadcaster, it's your duty going into those games, and I know you don't have much time, but you will prepare for it. And the question's been asked a couple of days ago, you know, what can we say about this player? So you've all the time to go individually. That every player has to tell a story, basically. Okay, there's so many individual stories, and I think having 32 teams is a great adventure, because you can tell those stories. As a broadcaster, it's also the duty, you know, to observe, you know, the game. And if we see something similar then with the Thailand-US game, then to explain the audience why this happens and go down to these individual stories. How big is the difference between these two teams and the way they train, they play, the payment and all these kind of things? And observe how the players react to it. You know, what are they doing after the fifth or sixth goal? And that's all the duty. So a lot can be talked about in those 90 minutes. And I think that's the responsibility of all the broadcasters to prepare really well for it, kind of go through it ahead. You know, there might be a double figure score. What are we going to do during the game? And tell those stories and why it happens. And I think there's a lot to be talked about. And that's why I do like the fact that there's 32 teams in this tournament.
If I can actually interject here in the case of Haiti as well, as broadcasters, are you going to talk about the fact that Haiti is coming out of one of the most awful crises of any football federation, and where there has been a cover-up as well by FIFA and some very serious allegations? I mean, when I mean very, very serious allegations of systematic abuse of those girls. Are you going to be able to talk about this as broadcasters? I know it's a tough one.
We should talk about it, right? Like, that's how I view it. But depends on your network and the type of image they have, I guess. So that makes it quite difficult. And Thomas is right, as broadcasters, we have a responsibility to a degree to give a very real picture as best as we possibly can. I know that's not always possible for a lot of broadcasters to be able to do that, but by all means, if we have room I think it's important.
I think the quality of the punditry is very, very important, and this is a chance for the World Cup to have more female pundits. It's a female game. I know Emma Hayes. I watched, obviously, English TV, and Emma Hayes has been fantastic. She's as good as anybody. You know, 100 caps for England. Emma Hayes is speaking far more sense. But the danger is, if someone doesn't do their homework, that's the biggest crime. So they've got to do their homework. They've got to get away from the cliches. Some of the men are shockers. You know, absolute, awful idiots. But to be fair, so are some of the females. And you can't hide, you can't say, oh, don't insult her because she's a female. She's a pundit. That's what she should be judged on, her punditry ability to do the homework, to understand the game. And that's what someone like Emma Hayes, if you get a chance to hear her, she's spot on.
Yeah, but I think with the broadcasters, though, that there's always this, they're caught between this conflict as rights holders in criticising. FIFA are the ones who are granting these rights out to broadcasters. And if they're criticising FIFA's structures, you know, for allowing abuse, you know, in this case with Haiti, you know, the serious allegations there around sexual abuse, I'm not sure that some of those broadcasters feel that that's what their audience want to hear. And so quite often, the pundits, the commentators, the journalists on there, they self-censor, you know, and that's not because they, sometimes they're probably told you can't, or once they've spoken about those issues, they're probably told, look, you know, let's focus on the football, you know, that's what the crowd, that's what the audience want to talk about. And so, or sometimes a lot of these people just self-censor. So it's not as easy as that, as people just saying broadcasters have a responsibility. They do, but unfortunately in the real world, the people paying the pundits are going to tell them or circumscribe what they can talk about on air.
That's a big question. Yeah, Thomas, yes. We could. I think this is actually a whole debate in itself, because you could argue as well that, well, maybe this is a chance for actually women's football to show the way. That's, you know, let's use that. There's no reason, because in men's football, it is shockingly, shamefully ignored as well.
Maybe there's an opportunity, because I went through this not so long ago with Qatar, and I think in the run-up to the Qatar World Cup, FIFA's been slacked off big time, okay? And I totally get you, and we had that experience for weeks in Germany. We've been reporting about the human rights conditions in Qatar, and the viewing figures were not impressive at all, okay? So they probably said, look, we can't do this again. So maybe the way forward in this case is not just criticizing FIFA non-stop, but as I said, there is an opportunity to show the audience what Haiti is like as a country. You know, of course you can talk about the issues around, you know, the players and the systemic abuse that happens, but in general, this is the beauty about World Cup. So many people suddenly, you know, look at this team and find out more about the country. And there is a middle way, I think, especially here in the women's game, where you teach the audience about what is going on in this country, under which conditions do these players train, what is it like to escape, you know, where they're from. You don't always have to, and I totally agree with you, criticize FIFA before, during, and after the game. We've gone through this. I think it's still necessary, you know, to watch closely what's going on, but you also have the opportunity to tell the stories of the players and of the countries that they represent.
Time for one more? One more question? Two more questions, perhaps? At the back?
Just a quick one. Which of the teams from pots 3 and 4 are going to stir the pot and get through their groups?
Could you repeat the question?
Yep. So which teams from pots 3 and 4 from the draw are going to stir the pot and get through to the round knockout rounds? From pots 3 and 4?
Yeah. Who? Groups or
remember
pots?
That far back? Okay. I'll forget the pots. Just who do you think is going to get through to the round of 16? That'll be
oh
some
my goodness,
surprise.
That would take us down and another rabbit hole. And to be honest, we've been in a real warren today. So perhaps, if you don't mind, maybe we'll think about this one. But take the question here, Just here.
With any World Cup, there's always great stories that emerge, and I think there's so many narratives, potentially with Marta in her sixth World Cup, which is just an incredible achievement. Haiti and teams like this qualifying, Australia obviously on home soil, and Sam Kerr to even go beyond a superstar into the stratosphere. I guess, are there any sort of narrative stories, something that you're really excited about for this World Cup to come?
Who would like to take this on? I heard the word Marta.
I think it'll be great to see how the Philippines do after the way Alan Stajic was awfully treated. I won't say got a point to prove, because he hasn't got any point to prove, but I would say he wouldn't have loved to get a result against Australia, wouldn't he?
I think in 2019 was a very important moment to see the fans and the female fans. It's like establishing a new female culture of rooting for the teams, and I think we're going to be seeing more of this here. So I'm very excited to hear the fans' stories. And for Brazil, for instance, we have a record of female journalists coming to Australia to cover the World Cup. So I'm very interested on, of course, the players are the stars, but also other women in the World Cup having their stories told and telling the stories as well.
Who would like to take this on? Any story you're looking forward to, even though we don't really know the stories that we're going to write about and talk about?
I think it could be Clash of the Titans. So we know that Rapinoe is going to retire. You know, she's going to absolutely go for it this World Cup. It's going to be Marta's last World Cup. Wendy Raynor, potentially her last yep. World Cup. So I'm looking forward to the Clash of the Titans and which of these really big name players see it as a stage that they can go out, you know, in a blaze of glory.
Yeah, and Eugenie Le Sommer as well, I think, yeah. Probably her last World Cup. Alicia?
Jean, once again, you take my thoughts. But no, for me, it's Marta. I think she's contributed so much to women's football over 21 years. It's an amazing career. I played against Marta in 2002. That gives you the idea of how long she's been around, but not just around, she's just been that standout player every major tournament, many major tournaments, what she brings to football and women's football. Olga, I'm hoping you get as far as possible your team, because I'd love to see Marta in the competition as long as possible.
Tom Somani, the ex-Matildas coach, had Marta in USA, and he said, Dabs, she's a better player than me. So, I mean, for Tommy to say that, she must be a bit special.
The discourse from the Brazilian players is they want to repeat what Argentina did for Messi last year, so they want to play to give Marta her last World Cup. So I think it will be like a boost in the, you know, spirit of the team.
I think that's actually a great point to end on, with celebration of one of the greatest talents the game has ever seen. I saw her as well. I had the privilege to see her when she was playing in Europe and play against Arsenal and making complete fools of our team, but there you go. So to Marta, yes, I think we're all raising, bending in recognition of her absolutely astonishing talent. But thank you very much, all of you, for taking part. Olga, Thomas, Steve, Claire, Kira, Francis, Jean, Alicia. So thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast, which was recorded at the Football Writers Festival in Sydney in July 2023. A festival for readers, writers, thinkers, and dreamers. If you want to know more about the festival, head to footballwritersfestival.com.au. If you're interested in some of the books talked about during the discussion, head to fairplaypublishing.com.au.